Disc 21. They circled each other, bare feet grating on the floor, watching with eyes intent for the slightest opening. "How beautifully you dance," Fade Rauther said. He's a talker, Paul thought. There's another weakness. He grows uneasy in the face of silence. "Have you been shriven?" Fade Rauther asked. Still, Paul circled in silence. And the old reverend mother, watching the fight from the press of the emperor's suite, felt herself trembling. The Atreides youth had called the Harkonnen cousin. It could only mean he knew the ancestry they shared. Easy to understand because he was the Kwisatz Haderach. But the words forced her to focus on the only thing that mattered to her here. This could be a major catastrophe for the Bene Gesserit breeding scheme. She had seen something of what Paul had seen here, that Fade Rauther might kill but not be victorious. Another thought, though, almost overwhelmed her. Two end products of this long and costly program faced each other in a fight to the death that might easily claim both of them. If both died here, that would leave only Fade Rauther's bastard daughter, still a baby, an unknown, an unmeasured factor, and Aaliyah, the abomination. "Perhaps you have only pagan rites here," Fade Rauther said. "Would you like the Emperor's truthsayer to prepare your spirit for its journey?" Paul smiled, circling to the right, alert, his black thoughts suppressed by the needs of the moment. Fade Rauther leaped, fainting with right hand, but with the knife shifted in a blur to his left hand. Paul dodged easily, noting the shield-conditioned hesitation in Fade Rauther's thrust. Still, it was not as great a shield conditioning as some Paul had seen, and he sensed that Fade Rauther had fought before against unshielded foes. "Doesn't Atreides run or stand and fight?" Fade Rauther asked. Paul resumed his silent circling. Idaho's words came back to him, the words of training from the long-ago practice floor on Caladan. "Use the first moments in study. You may miss many an opportunity for quick victory this way, but the moments of study are insurance of success. Take your time and be sure. Perhaps you think this dance prolongs your life a few moments," Fade Rauther said. "Well and good." He stopped the circling, straightened. Paul had seen enough for a first approximation. Fade Rauther led to the left side, presenting the right hip as though the mailed fighting girdle could protect his entire side. It was the action of a man trained to the shield and with a knife in both hands. And Paul hesitated. The girdle was more than it seemed. The Harkonnen appeared too confident against a man who this day led the forces of victory against Sardaukar legions. Fade Rauther noted the hesitation, said, "Why prolong the inevitable? You but keep me from exercising my rights over this ball of dirt." If it's a flip dart, Paul thought, it's a cunning one. The girdle shows no signs of tampering. "Why don't you speak?" Fade Rauther demanded. Paul resumed his probing circle, allowing himself a cold smile at the tone of unease in Fade Rauther's voice, evidence that the pressure of silence was building. "You smile, eh?" Fade Rauther asked, and he leaped in mid-sentence. Expecting the slight hesitation, Paul almost failed to evade the downflash of blade, felt its tip scratch his left arm. He silenced the sudden pain there, his mind flooded with realization that the earlier hesitation had been a trick, and over-faint. Here was more of an opponent than he had expected. There would be tricks within tricks within tricks. "Your own Thufir Hawat taught me some of my skills," Fade Rautha said. "He gave me first blood. Too bad the old fool didn't live to see it." And Paul recalled that Idaho had once said, "Expect only what happens in the fight. That way you'll never be surprised." Again, the two circled each other, crouched, cautious. Paul saw the return of elation to his opponent, wondered at it. Did a scratch signify that much to the man? Unless there were poison on the blade. But how could there be? His own men had handled the weapon, snooped it before passing it. They were too well trained to miss an obvious thing like that. "That woman you were talking to over there," Fade Rautha said. "The little one. Is she something special to you? A pet, perhaps? Will she deserve my special attentions?" Paul remained silent, probing with his inner senses, examining the blood from the wound, finding a trace of soporific from the Emperor's blade. He realigned his own metabolism to match this threat and change the molecules of the soporific, but he felt a thrill of doubt. They'd been prepared with soporific on a blade. A soporific. Nothing to alert a poison snooper, but strong enough to slow the muscles it touched. His enemies had their own plans within plans, their own stacked treacheries. Again, Fade Rautha leaped, stabbing. Paul, the smile frozen on his face, fainted with slowness as though inhibited by the drug, and at the last instant dodged to meet the down-flashing arm on the Chris knife's point. Fade Rautha ducked sideways and was out and away. His blade shifted to his left hand, and the measure of him that only a slight paleness of jaw betrayed the acid pain where Paul had cut him. Let him know his own moment of doubt, Paul thought. Let him suspect poison. "Treachery!" Fade Rautha shouted. "He's poisoned me! I do feel poison in my arm!" Paul dropped his cloak of silence, said only a little acid to counter the soporific on the Emperor's blade. Fade Rautha matched Paul's cold smile, lifted blade in left hand for a mock salute. His eyes glared rage behind the knife. Paul shifted his Chris knife to his left hand, matching his opponent. Again, they circled, probing. Fade Rautha began closing the space between them, edging in, knife held high, anger showing itself in squint of eye and set of jaw. He feinted right and under, and they were pressed against each other, knife hands gripped, straining. Paul, cautious of Fade Rautha's right hip, where he suspected a poison flip dart, forced the turn to the right. He almost failed to see the needle point flick out beneath the belt line. A shift and a giving in Fade Rautha's motion warned him. The tiny point missed Paul's flesh by the barest fraction. On the left hip. Treachery within treachery within treachery, Paul reminded himself. Using Bene Gesserit-trained muscles, he sagged to catch a reflex in Fade Rautha, but the necessity of avoiding the tiny point jutting from his opponent's hip threw Paul off just enough that he missed his footing and found himself thrown hard to the floor, Fade Rautha on top. "You see it there on my hip?" Fade Rautha whispered. "Your death, fool." And he began twisting himself around, forcing the poisoned needle closer and closer. "It'll stop your muscles, and my knife will finish you. There'll be never a trace left to detect. Paul strained, hearing the silent screams in his mind, his cell-stamped ancestors demanding that he use the secret word to slow Fade Rautha, to save himself. "I will not say it," Paul gasped. Fade Rautha gaped at him, caught in the merest fraction of hesitation. It was enough for Paul to find the weakness of balance in one of his opponent's leg muscles, and their positions were reversed. Fade Rautha lay partly underneath with right hip high, unable to turn because of the tiny needle point caught against the floor beneath him. Paul twisted his left hand free, aided by the lubrication of blood from his arm, thrust once hard up underneath Fade Rautha's jaw. The point slid home into the brain. Fade Rautha jerked and sagged back, still held partly on his side by the needle embedded in the floor. Breathing deeply to restore his calm, Paul pushed himself away and got to his feet. He stood over the body, knife in hand, raised his eyes with deliberate slowness to look across the room at the Emperor. "Majesty," Paul said, "your force is reduced by one more. Shall we now shed sham and pretense? Shall we now discuss what must be? Your daughter wed to me, and the way opened for an Atreides to sit on the throne." The Emperor turned, looked at Count Fenring. The Count met his stare, gray eyes against green. The thought lay there clearly between them, their association so long that understanding could be achieved with a glance. "Kill this upstart for me," the Emperor was saying. "The Atreides is young and resourceful, yes, but he is also tired from long effort, and he'd be no match for you anyway. Call him out now. You know the way of it. Kill him." Slowly, Fenring moved his head, a prolonged turning until he faced Paul. "Do it," the Emperor hissed. The Count focused on Paul, seeing with eyes his Lady Margot had trained in the Bene Gesserit way, aware of the mystery and hidden grandeur about this Atreides youth. "I could kill him," Fenring thought, and he knew this for a truth. Something in his own secretive depths stayed the Count then, and he glimpsed briefly, inadequately, the advantage he held over Paul. A way of hiding from the youth, a furtiveness of person and motives that no eye could penetrate. Paul, aware of some of this from the way the time nexus boiled, understood at last why he had never seen Fenring along the webs of prescience. Fenring was one of the might-have-beens, an almost Kwisatz Haderach, crippled by a flaw in the genetic pattern. A eunuch, his talent concentrated into furtiveness and inner seclusion. A deep compassion for the Count flowed through Paul, the first sense of brotherhood he'd ever experienced. Fenring, reading Paul's emotion, said, "Majesty, I must refuse." Rage overcame Shaddam IV. He took two short steps through the entourage, cuffed Fenring viciously across the jaw. A dark flush spread up and over the Count's face. He looked directly at the Emperor, spoke with deliberate lack of emphasis. "We have been friends, Majesty. What I do now is out of friendship. I shall forget that you struck me." Paul cleared his throat, said, "We were speaking of the throne, Majesty. The Emperor whirled, glared at Paul. "I sit on the throne," he barked. "You shall have a throne on Seleucus Secundus," Paul said. "I put down my arms and came here on your word of bond," the Emperor shouted. "You dare threaten?" "Your person is safe in my presence," Paul said. "And Atreides promised it. Muad'Dib, however, sentences you to your prison planet. But have no fear, Majesty. I will ease the harshness of the place with all the powers at my disposal. It shall become a garden world, full of gentle things." As the hidden import of Paul's words grew in the Emperor's mind, he glared across the room at Paul. "Now we see true motives," he sneered. "Indeed," Paul said. "And what of Arrakis?" the Emperor asked. "Another garden world full of gentle things?" "The Fremen have the word of Muad'Dib," Paul said. "There will be flowing water here open to the sky, and green oases rich with good things. But we have the spice to think of, too. Thus there will always be desert on Arrakis, and fierce winds, and trials to toughen a man. We Fremen have a saying, God created Arrakis to train the faithful. One cannot go against the word of God." The old truthsayer, the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, had her own view of the hidden meaning in Paul's words now. She glimpsed the jihad and said, "You cannot loose these people upon the universe. You will think back to the gentle ways of the Sardaukar," Paul snapped. "You cannot," she whispered. "You're a truthsayer," Paul said. "Review your words." He glanced at the Princess Royal, back to the Emperor. "Best be done quickly, Majesty." The Emperor turned a stricken look upon his daughter. She touched his arm, spoke soothingly. "For this I was trained, Father." He took a deep breath. "You cannot stay this thing," the old truthsayer muttered. The Emperor straightened, standing stiffly with a look of remembered dignity. "Who will negotiate for you, kinsman?" he asked. Paul turned, saw his mother, her eyes heavy-lidded, standing with Chaney and a squad of Fedaikan guards. He crossed to them, stood looking down at Chaney. "I know the reasons," Chaney whispered. "If it must be, Usul." Paul, hearing the secret tears in her voice, touched her cheek. "My Sihaya need fear nothing, ever," he whispered. He dropped his arm, faced his mother. "You will negotiate for me, mother. With Chaney by your side. She has wisdom and sharp eyes, and it is wisely said that no one bargains tougher than a Fremen. She will be looking through the eyes of her love for me, and with the thought of her sons to be what they will need. Listen to her." Jessica sensed the harsh calculation in her son, put down a shudder. "What are your instructions?" she asked. "The Emperor's entire Chome Company holdings as dowry," he said. "Entire?" She was shocked, almost speechless. "He is to be stripped. I'll want an earldom and Chome directorship for Gurney Halleck, and him in the fief of Caladan. There will be titles and attendant power for every surviving Atreides man, not excepting the lowliest trooper." "What of the Fremen?" Jessica asked. "The Fremen are mine," Paul said. "What they receive shall be dispensed by Muad'Dib. It'll begin with Stilgar as governor on Arrakis. But that can wait. And for me? Jessica asked. Is there something you wish? Perhaps, Caladan, she said, looking at Gurney. I'm not certain. I've become too much the Fremen, and the Reverend Mother. I need a time of peace and stillness in which to think. That you shall have, Paul said, and anything else that Gurney or I can give you. Jessica nodded, feeling suddenly old and tired. She looked at Chaney. And for the royal concubine? No title for me, Chaney whispered. Nothing. I beg of you. Paul stared down into her eyes, remembering her suddenly as she had stood once with little Leto in her arms, their child now dead in this violence. I swear to you now, he whispered, that you will need no title. That woman over there will be my wife, and you but a concubine, because this is a political thing, and we must weld peace out of this moment. Enlist the great houses of the Landsrod. We must obey the forms. Yet that princess shall have no more of me than my name. No child of mine, nor touch, nor softness of glance, nor instant of desire. So you say now, Chaney said. She glanced across the room at the tall princess. Do you know so little of my son? Jessica whispered. See that princess standing there, so haughty and confident. They say she has pretensions of a literary nature. Let us hope she finds solace in such things. She'll have little else. A bitter laugh escaped Jessica. Think on it, Chaney. That princess will have the name, yet she'll live as less than a concubine, never to know a moment of tenderness from the man to whom she's bound. While we, Chaney, we who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives.